And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
One of my long-term projects is to create a series of lists that are based not necessarily on my thinking, but some of the best minds in the industry. What do they think, for example, is the most important decision you make? What do they think that one has to do to become successful in managing your money or managing your financial life? So I'm in the hunt to find great lists of 3 or 5 or 10 things that that you might see that have to do with the most important decisions. And my hope is to catalog these, and from maybe 100 or 200 different lists, to pick out the 10 most popular recommendations, the most life-changing recommendations. So if you do see a list that you think might be helpful in this regard, and it might be for a first-time investor, it might be for a retiree, but forward those lists to paul@paulmerriman.com, and I will put them in my database here for my consideration. Now, this is not going to be a major project until I am done with introducing this new strategy, the Two Funds for Life, and we've got our hands full over the next 45 days to get everything done to present this at the AAII convention conference in Las Vegas late October, to get the article about the strategy up on our site and in a Money Watch article at the same time, and to have this wonderful work that Chris Pedersen has been doing to get it all documented, and to get an article from Chris as he sees it. I see it as a way to help the very, very first-time investor who really doesn't understand the process. I see it as a tremendous strategy for those people. But Chris has dug into the numbers behind this strategy, and the really amazing differences between little changes in the strategy, going back to long ago as 1926. So I'm very excited, and I'm trying not to take on any more projects while I'm getting this one off our collective desks. But here's a list that was sent to me from an old friend, affectionately known as the Mutual Fund Geek. And this one is about 10 things Mark Cuban says to do with your money. And I'm sure most of you know who Mark Cuban is. He's a very wealthy guy, for one thing. So that might be interesting to find out what he thinks we might be willing or able to do to end up like Mark Cuban. You may know him on the CNBC show Shark Tank, and he's also the owner of the Dallas Mavericks and a successful investor. In the article, they say that he made his first million in 1990 after selling his business to CompuServe, and then earned a $5.9 billion paycheck after he sold his online streaming audio service to Yahoo in 1999. To you, those of you who don't believe of the importance of timing, think about his timing in selling that audio service to Yahoo in 1999. That's pretty doggone close to the peak. The article makes the point that he knows how to be rich and successful, and he also takes a lot of time to share his insight. And in this particular piece, the author of this article, he had gone through a number of Cubans' podcasts and articles to pull out the pieces of financial advice that he says will help you learn how to think like a billionaire. Now, when I first saw that, I thought, boy, who wouldn't like to be able to think like a billionaire? Although I must say that possibly in trying to be a billionaire, we may find ourselves concluding at the end of that struggle that it might have been better to have focused on becoming a millionaire or a multi-millionaire or just having enough to be happy in retirement. I mean, there are a lot of other things other than being a billionaire that are important. But the fact is that Mark Cuban, as far as I'm concerned, has clearly shown he has the background to share with people how to think like a billionaire. But I want to know and I want to explore the difference between thinking like a billionaire or whether you'd be better off to learn how to think like a millionaire. I'm almost 75, next month turn 75, and I've had success as an investor at kind of every level. I had success as an investor where I put money aside, like every one of you can put money aside, put that money in passive investments that had really very little risk and virtually no work on my part. And doing that over many years, in fact, made over $1 million. And I've had investments that had a lot of risk, a ton of risk, but required no work on my part. And again, I had the good fortune of making a lot of money. And finally, I had the good fortune of investing very few dollars in a long-term investment. By the way, it could have been a very short-term investment. Could have been writing off a loss of $15,000. But I invested that, and then I put in years and years of sweat equity. And in fact, it was that particular investment that made way more than all of the other approaches to make $1 million. But I have to say, in every case, I had the good fortune, because all of these things that I did, they happened during a period of time when it was much easier. Or let's put it this way, the market cooperated, the economy cooperated. What I was doing fit. When I started my investment management company in 1983, I started it at a time when really very few people were doing this, the kind of work I was doing. And then in 1993, when I started working with Dimensional Funds, it was a very small group of people who were using DFA to help their clients who wanted buy and hold. But the bottom line is good fortune, good luck was instrumental, along with either a lot of patience or a lot of work. But if I had a chance to counsel someone who wanted my advice on how to make millions, my first objective would be to find out how you want to do it. And the fact is that's a lot of work. I mean, the real way that I could help somebody figure out how they could take whatever talent they have or whatever ability they have to earn, and then whatever ability they have to save, and it's going to be different strokes for different folks, as you know. And so there is no magic bullet in this process. Certainly, what we're trying to do on our website and with all the work that we're doing with our writings and podcasts and videos is to be able to teach a way, share a way that I think anybody who has the ability to earn and save and invest could put to work in their life. So I'm going to go through these 10 things that Mark Cuban said. I'll read right from the article, if I might, so that you get the language from Mark and the author. Number one, be a little bit of a risk taker. Talk to any self-made millionaires or billionaires, and they might preach the importance of taking calculated risks. Sometimes risks and rewards go hand in hand, as Cuban pointed out in a 2017 interview with Money Magazine, while discounting the value of investing your savings. He explained that it's possible to save $1 million, but only if you're disciplined and take risks. Many who achieve higher levels of financial success aren't afraid to invest for the betterment of their future, whether they're investing in the market, a business, or their education. Well, my goal, I guess my challenge for investors, is to make sure they don't take risks for which there is not an expected return or premium. And I guess it's more important, the word premium, than return, because you might get a return but not have been compensated for all the risk that you take. And the average return, for example, of all large cap growth stocks, it's been around 10%. So if 1,000 of us pick one stock, the compound rate of return will be on average 10%, but it's also possible there won't be one company out of 1,000 that makes exactly 10%. 500 might make more than 10%, and 500 may make less. The problem is that nobody knows the firms that will make less and the firms that will make more. Now, the same would be true with small cap value stocks. But in that case, the return, at least based on history, is expected to be 3 to 5% more a year. Academics will argue that buying one company does not come with an expected premium over buying all the companies in that asset class. That just seems so counterintuitive. And I think that the individual stock picker, the person who believes in doing all the studying and reading up on the company and checking the financials of that company and their competitors and all of that, they do all of that work. They all believe, I think they all believe, that they are likely to get a premium over the rest of the folks who aren't doing all that hard work. And the tendency, of course, for us in most parts of our life is to be overconfident. Now, what's fascinating to me, and this just came up in the last couple of years, is this study by Dr. Bessem Binder, looking at all public companies from 1926 to, I think, 2016. And it's fascinating that less than 4% of the companies accounted for most of that 10% return that we commonly expect from the market in the long term. 4%. The other 96% had an average return about the same as T-bills, around 3%. So it's a possibility that the majority of the investors who picked one stock actually not only made less than the S&P 500 or that famous 10% return, but they may have made about the same on average as T-bills. Now, probably that's unlikely because a lot of those people who picked one company would probably pick a company that that there's a ton of information on that a lot of people like and has a great reputation for being a fine company. And then probably as a group, those are the companies that are more likely to be in that 8 to 10% range than the 3 to 4%. But for those, and I'm thinking now about this risk that Cuban is trying to get us to take, for those who want to make market rates of return, who are not looking for the billion, but are looking for the million or the 3 million or the 5 million, that you are most likely to do it with a massively diversified portfolio, not a narrow 20-stock portfolio. And that's a big difference, I think, from what Mark Cuban would probably be trying to communicate with young investors. So that's what I would add to his comments. Number two, put it in the bank. The author says, in an exclusive interview with Young Money, a personal finance education and media company, Cuban offered this general investing advice and then followed the statement by saying, the idiots that tell you to put your money in the market because eventually it will go up need to tell you that's because they are trying to sell you something. The stock market is probably the worst investment vehicle out there. Now, I totally disagree. I'll agree with this part, that it's not unusual that the person who's telling you you should put your money in some investment, whether it's stocks or bonds, may be doing it because they're trying to sell you something. But what's the evidence that the stock market is probably the worst investment vehicle out there? Now, if we talk about a diversified portfolio that has compounded at 10% or a more risky diversified portfolio that has compounded at 13 or 14 or in some long periods as much as 16%, and you have these massively diversified portfolios, I really don't think that one would say that's the worst investment vehicle out there. Now, somebody might go so far as to say, look, if I buy a piece of real estate, a house, and I put 10% down or 20% down, and I hold it for 30 years, I could make a huge return on what I put in there. But think about this, if you looked at history. If you put down 10 or 20%, and you leverage the rest in a massively diversified portfolio, yes, you're going to have some times, as it has happened in the real estate market, that there would be people who got blown away by declines in the price of real estate or the declines in the price of stocks, but the returns would be humongous over many 40-year periods. Remember, the worst 40-year period for the S&P 500 is a compound rate of return of 8.5, and the very best was 12.5. But here's how I feel about this comment about the stock market is probably the worst investment vehicle out there. See, I'm guessing that most of you are going to accumulate your money, your retirement money now, through making regular dollar-cost averaging investments into your 401k, where you're going to be diversified, whether they're actively managed funds or passively managed funds, you're going to be in mutual funds. Now, some of you may have the ability to self-direct within an account at Fidelity or Schwab, where you're going to go in and pick your best stocks. Maybe you can do that. At some level, I guess, I hope not, because I think for that base, that foundation of retirement, it would be smarter and safer and still be profitable if you just did it with a diversified rather than a focused portfolio. And you're going to have choices. You're going to have choices for bonds, for gold, for commodities. Even in the form of mutual funds, you can get gold. And even in the form of mutual funds, you can be exposed to commodities or ETFs, exchange-traded funds. But in fact, from everything I know about the investing process, the stock market is probably the best investment vehicle out there. And remember that piece we did several months ago about small cap value, what could go wrong? And we looked back at the 1929 through 38 market where people just got wiped out. They lost half of their money or more if they put money in at the beginning of that period of time. But if they invested every year at the end of that 10-year period, instead of having lost money, you actually compounded your investment at over 10% a year. And that's because when people think about the stock market being the worst investment vehicle, yeah, that's when there's a terrible bear market. But for people who are investing for the long term, those terrible bear markets, for those who dollar cost average into massively diversified equity portfolios, it's really a good thing to do, not bad. It is easy to think back about what made us feel good and to think that what we did that made a lot of money was really smart. But I also know in my own case where I made that $15,000 investment and then I put a bunch of sweat equity into building a company, I also know that according to studies, something like 1 in 15 new companies make it. And so the odds were against me. And what I'm looking for are ways that you're going to end up being a multimillionaire where the odds are actually with you. And if we're to think that the smart thing is not the stock market, but to find some people who, for example, could manage your money the way only the wealthy can manage it, maybe even use some leverage like they do in hedge funds. Well, what do we know about the long-term viability? Forget about the return, but the viability of hedge funds built for the wealthy, not built for people trying to get to a million, but people who already have a million or a lot more. We know, according to the studies, that about 5% of the hedge funds are still in existence after 10 years. And now I'm going to go back to this piece on Cuban, still under number two. Although some investors believe the stock market is the ticket to wealth, others believe the market is too risky and volatile. Your stock can be profitable one day, yet it only takes one downturn to lose it all. Now, I've just got to stop right there. Yes, something bad could happen in a downturn, certainly in 2008. We're talking a lot recently about what happened in 2008. And Lehman Brothers certainly took a turn for the worse. And so, yes, really bad things can happen. So what Cuban says is rather than put all your eggs in the stock market, he wants you to keep some money in a savings account for a rainy day so you've protected it if something goes wrong. And you might say, well, okay, that makes sense. You should have, but that has nothing to do with investing. That has to do with being prudent and hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst. But he goes on to say, and the author says this is in Cuban's words, quote, Buy and hold is a sucker's game. Those who put their money in CDs sleep well at night and definitely have more money today than they did yesterday. Yes, you know, that is what keeps so many young people from investing in the stock market, is they're scared to death that they're going to put it there and tomorrow it will be worth less than it is today. That is why there is a premium for investing in stocks. The good news is there's almost the same premium, maybe even a better premium if you own 10,000 companies than if you own 10. So anytime we say something, there's a lot of discussion recently over the last couple of years about how important words are, that words count, comments count. And I'm always worried that somebody who, I mean, after all, somebody's got the Dallas, owns the Dallas Mavericks. Somebody's got, he's on national TV. I mean, this is the kind of things that happen that make you believe that if this man speaks, you got to be listening, soaking in all that information about buy and hold is a sucker's game. Buy and hold properly done for the long term, and maybe it does include some fixed income in order to maintain the losses during the worst of times. Yes, smart people would do that too. But for young people, in a sense, we want you to experience the worst of times, those early years of investing, because, see, that's what happened in that 1929 through 1938 period. That saving into equities, if there were such a thing as a 401k back then, you would have been putting money in there every month, and other people would maybe jumping out of windows, and that was, by the way, not that many people jumped out of windows. That's been overblown, but bottom line is that you were accumulating, if you were accumulating a diversified portfolio, and oh yes, there were mutual funds back in 29. You were accumulating asset classes that obviously were risky because they were down and dirty at that point, but eventually turned around as a group. What are the chances of becoming a millionaire putting money into CDs? You got to save a lot of money. Number three, find a way to invest inexpensively in the market. If you want to dabble in the market, Cuban advises doing so safely to minimize your risk. You know, that's a very important concept. People oftentimes think only in terms of the market going down. See, the market has always, as a whole, recovered. And particularly favorably for those who were able to put money away when the market was grossly out of favor. But what we need to understand, and we need to teach our young people, is the risk of high expenses, the risk of turnover inside of the mutual fund, the buying and the selling, the risk of paying loads. Those are just as real as the risk of loss in a market downturn. In fact, there is not an example where, because you took the risk of paying high expenses year after year after year, that when you're 65, all of a sudden something magic happens and you get that all back. Those expenses are real risks. Back to the article. In his conversation with Money, he suggested investing in low-cost mutual funds. These are investments that let you pool your assets with assets of other investors, which, for most investors, provides a cheaper way to diversify your portfolio. As Cuban puts it, If you can find a way to invest inexpensively in the market, you can start to build your net worth. Now, I'm totally in agreement with that comment. And by the way, I'm going to be in agreement with a number of his comments, so this is not all just to put him down. I just want to think through what his words might mean. Number four, if you don't fully understand the risks of an investment you are contemplating, it's okay to do nothing. Cuban gave this advice in a blog titled, "The Best Investment Advice You Will Ever Get." Although investing can build your net worth and put you on the path toward financial freedom, there's no guarantee that an investment strategy will pay off. Well, that, you know, this is an interesting challenge. This idea that if you don't understand the risks of an investment, it's okay to do nothing. Because at some level, there is, in fact, that makes sense. If you don't understand something, you shouldn't invest in it. But so often, what it is that people don't really understand is the nature of risk. And so they always have this this possibility of postponing the decision because I just don't know enough. I think the market might go down a little further and I want to get in when it's cheaper. Whoops, it's going up. I'm sure it's going to sell off and I'll have a chance to get in again. There's all of these kind of emotional forces that you're going to face. And at some point, I suspect, the one thing that people really struggle with is this idea that they need to know about how much they're going to make, and they want to know how much they're going to lose in order to make that amount they're going to make. And unfortunately, we're not allowed to see that. And the people who are able to, I'm going to use the word con, investors into believing that they do know, those are the most dangerous people of all, because if you can conclude that somebody knows the future, oh my God, you don't need diversification. You don't need to own an index fund. In fact, it doesn't even matter if the product or the investment is expensive because he or she knows. Well, unfortunately, he or she does not know. He says, before investing, make sure you know the risks and prepare for the possibility of losing money. Now, I suspect if you studied enough of Mark Cuban's article, enough of the blogs and articles that he's either written or been quoted in, that you would find a lot of things that, in a way, contradict each other, but he might be talking about slightly different subjects in each case. But yes, prepare for the possibility of losing money. Now, think about that. The possibility? Well, the possibility of losing money is 100%. The question is how large the loss will be. If you held the S&P 500, I said earlier that you would have had a minimum return of about 8.5 over looking at all the 40-year period since 1926, you would have made 8.5. Worst case, but there was another 40-year period, is 12.5. But also during those 40-year periods, there was a loss of 30 to 50+%. And in one 10-year period, 2000 to 2009, twice the market went down over 50%. So, loss is not just a possibility. It's going to happen. It just depends how long you own the investment. And by the way, I want to identify a loss as from whatever recent high something might have been. You may think, and I've seen this happen in people's thinking, if they put in $1,000 and it has grown to $20,000 and then it falls to $10,000, they will say, I've never lost money in the market. Wrong. They have, but they still have more than they started. And so my goal for investors is to figure out a way to get to $20,000 with that $1,000, knowing that it will, instead of going back down to $10,000, might only go down to $15,000, because the losses are part of the process. Going on in the article, if you have doubts or if there's too much uncertainty surrounding an investment, there's nothing wrong with holding on to your cash until the right opportunity comes along. Now, that's an interesting decision to make that, as a way of addressing the investment process, because most people would say that those who hold on to cash waiting for the right opportunity, you know, we're not all Warren Buffetts, that in fact it does not add to long-term return. See, there's the problem is here that there's always list A, the good news, and always list B, the bad news about the market, about an industry, about an individual company. Because if you look at the market day to day, for every 100 shares of Google that you see traded, there is a buyer and there is a seller. So you know what each one is thinking, and time will tell which one is in fact right. So if your nature, and this is one of the big challenges for a lot of you, if your nature is that you are pessimistic by nature, and lots of people are. Other people just, you know, rose-colored glasses, they just kind of float through life and don't see the risk out there. But the people who have this pessimistic view of people, of economies, of the world, etc., they may be more likely to look at the bad news. And because it's always there, it's pretty easy to stay on the sidelines. I unfortunately, because I would be worth a lot more money if I hadn't been so afraid of tomorrow, always afraid of the catastrophic event about to happen. The only way I've gotten over it is to just invest mechanically. And in my case, just have somebody else do it. I don't want anything to do with it except I want to establish the rules and regulations of managing my money, or I should say our money. So for many of you who are pessimistic or afraid, or can make a list of reasons to be concerned, the mechanical, discipline. Don't let your emotions get involved in the decision-making process. Again, I find it most easily done having somebody else do it, but still a set of rules and mechanically. So that, when you do it mechanically, forces you to invest when things are scary. And by the way, if you're dollar cost averaging in, it also forces you to buy fewer shares when things are expensive. Number five, don't let fear be a roadblock. Cuban shared this statement in his book, How to Win at the Sport of Business. If I can do it, you can do it. Fear is a natural feeling, but it's also one of the worst enemies to success. If you want to get ahead, get out of your own way and stop hiding behind fear. It keeps you stuck in the same place and stifles growth. If investing is new to you, fear and apprehension are normal. Rather than let it hold you back, educate yourself on different investment strategies to build your confidence. And when you are ready, start with cheaper, safer investments. Well, I sure cannot argue with that. And I think the The key here, to follow up on this cheaper and safer, I think the key is to make sure that you are controlling all the risks that can be controlled and be specific about the willingness to stomach the normal loss of investing and only invest money in higher risk in investments that you can afford to hold for the long term. That would be my feeling. Number six, be a smart shopper. There's a definite connection between being a smart shopper and a savvy investor. In a blog post, Cuban explains how cash creates transitional returns. He encourages analyzing how much you spend over the course of a year and then suggested taking advantage of cash quantity and discounts to get a better return on your money. In other words, it's best to buy in bulk. Saving 15% on $1,000 worth of items you know you will absolutely spend money on is a better return on your money than making 15% in a year on a $1,000 investment because you don't pay taxes on it, said Cuban. You know, I've really been focused recently on this ability to save. I talk to people that are so disciplined about saving and disciplined about investing. I never really thought of it that way, but I think Cuban is right that there is this something in common between the prudent saver and the prudent investor. Not always. A lot of good savers don't ever find the confidence to be a prudent investor. But a member of our board here at the foundation and a dear friend of many years, Paul Hayes, he's working on a new book entitled Spend Your Way to Wealth. I can't wait for it to come out. I've read a part of it, and I'm very excited on what I think it will teach young people about how to have good wealth. Not about being a billionaire, but certainly about being a millionaire plus. But it is largely dependent on how you spend. Number seven, rarely take third-party advice on investments. Cuban isn't afraid to march to the beat of his own drum, particularly when it comes to his money and investing. In an interview with Forbes, Cuban stated that he rarely takes third-party advice on his investments, thus underscoring an important point. Don't put all your trust in someone else. This doesn't mean you shouldn't seek guidance from financial advisors. Their insight is invaluable when you are just starting out and have limited investment knowledge. At the same time, don't give someone complete control over where your money goes. Learn the ins and outs of investing for yourself so you can have a say in how you invest your money. If you're just starting out, pick up a book to start learning, to which I say, amen, brother. I mean, I absolutely agree with that. And from my viewpoint, if you went to the library and checked out Your Money and Your Brain by Jason Zweig, if you checked out Mutual Funds for Dummies, if you checked out the little book of Common Sense Investing, that's a short read. It's beautiful. It's from John Bogle. I would encourage you to read books and articles by Larry Swedrow, S-W-E-D, as in dog, R-O-E. Jonathan Clements, another very good writer on saving and investing. Interesting. Entertaining. Both Swedrow and Clements are that. And I would hope that you would read articles on my website. You don't have to buy Financial Fitness Forever. It's nicely organized, takes you through the whole process. But if you just, in fact, there's a link on my homepage. It says Best Advice. Those are the most important articles, probably, that area right there. A handful of articles and tables that represent the best work that we've done. And I'd like you to, for those of you who would rather watch my videos, there are a couple of them there that are, one's 2.5 hours, and a couple of 50-minute pieces with lots of tables. But keep in mind that all of us, Swedrow and Zweig and Clements and Alan Roth is another very fine writer and smart guy about investing. But you do have to keep in mind that those of us who write about investing, we don't know anything about you personally. So if you're going to hire a professional counselor to help go through this investment process, make sure that you're headed down the path of unnecessary commissions. I don't want you looking at mutual funds with high expenses. I don't want you in actively managed funds. I want you to get advice, but I want you to learn what works and what doesn't work, and then work through the biases you have to make sure they aren't self-destructive. You may be the hurdle to your financial success. Number 8, and I love this one. Go to the cheapest school possible to get your freshman and maybe sophomore classes. College can be an excellent investment in your future and provide the skills and knowledge you need to improve your financial outlook. But acquiring said knowledge isn't without costs. Cuban offers a cheaper approach. Enroll in a local community college for the first couple of years of your undergraduate education. Some might argue for the benefits of attending a prestigious school, but Cuban encourages young people to think about the long-term financial ramifications. Quote, do you want to be saddled with $40,000, $50,000, $80,000, or $100,000 in debt? I'll give up the incremental value of freshman English at a great school to not have the stress, Cuban said. Boy, I'll tell you, I really, over the years, have struggled with this decision when working with parents and grandparents. Now, there are just a ton of people like myself who are going to get a college education. By the way, don't even have to go to college to get an education, but a lot of us do that, and we're encouraged to do that by our parents. I never even thought I had a chance. I thought it was required. But a lot of us are going to get basically a liberal arts background, and we're going to go out and we're going to find our way in the world, working someplace hopefully that meets our own personal, following your bliss, I think, as Joseph Campbell said. And that fortunately happened to me, and I've known lots of people that didn't happen to, and they can't wait to stop what they're doing and get on to the next part of their life. But here's what I do know, that I look at what my 26-year-old daughter did. She took, in her junior and senior year of high school, she participated in what they called Running Start. And she went to a junior college to finish her last 2 years of high school. And when she entered the University of Washington, she was a junior. And so then, with 2 more years, she was had graduated. And summa cum laude, by the way, she is one very bright young lady. And what she's doing now is teaching, which is what she wants to do. And since then, she's also gotten a couple of masters in different areas of teaching, education. But the money that she saved by going to Running Start and then going to a public institution, and I really, honestly, I don't think she was emotionally interested in going to Stanford to get an education. would have been proud if she had done that, whatever she wanted to do. But she found a way, and guess who benefits from that? She had help from her parents, but to the extent that she spent a little instead of a lot, guess whose 401k plan is now bigger than many people who are still working diligently to pay off 4 years of college costs. And those two masters that she got, one at USC and one at Northeastern, smart girl she is, thinking about being prudent with the money that she had accumulated. She did it online. She worked her tail off. And the classes were mostly live, so it was like being there, except she didn't have to pay the very high cost of going away to school. So, yeah, there's some things we can do, or our grandkids and our kids can do, that maybe for where they're likely to be in life, and who knows? I mean, look at people who end up being heads of corporations, presidents of countries. They don't all necessarily come from the very best schools. And maybe it didn't even help. Number 9, have disciplined spending. Cuban knows a thing or two about being disciplined and living frugal. After college, he moved into a house with 5 roommates, lived off macaroni and cheese, and drove an older vehicle. Rather than invest in expensive belongings, he invested in himself and his future goals. Likewise, a frugal mindset can propel you toward your goals. If you make money and build a nest egg, you'll have the resources needed to make smart investments. And of course, I should add, and learn how investing works. Don't let Wall Street dictate the way to your financial future. Please check out what the academics have to say. Live beneath your means and reduce spending to help build your savings. Consider driving an older car, buying secondhand goods, living with your parents a little longer, or getting a roommate to lower housing expenses. I was really proud of a young fellow I recently had lunch with, who's son of a friend. And he's going to live at home, take the bus to college, live at home during college. He's not going to walk away with a ton of debt. I'm really, really proud of the decisions he's making. Number 10, and this is the last one. Thank you for your patience here. Pay off credit cards after 30 days, or don't use them at all. Credit cards serve a useful purpose, but they can also lead to debt if you don't manage them responsibly, which is why Cuban gave this advice to consumers. He doesn't discourage using a credit card, but he does encourage paying off balances in full every month to avoid wasting money on interest. Quote, using a credit card is okay if you pay it off at the end of the month. Just recognize that the 18% or 20% or 30% you're paying in credit card debt is going to cost you a lot more than you could earn anywhere else. And he finishes the article, for advice on money and investing, seek out those with a successful track record. And let me just insert, be careful what you call a successful track record, because a 5 or 10 year track record may mean very little. And in fact, for my money, the only real track record of value is that of the longer term with asset classes. He goes on, your chances of a one-on-one session with Mark Cuban are probably slim to none, but this doesn't mean you can't benefit from his wisdom. Between his blogs, interviews, and Q&A sessions, he's proven that he's more than willing to share what he knows with others. And I think you'll find, by the way, that certainly my work is hoping to give aid and comfort, because sometimes comfort is important in a in an unsettled time, as well as I think there are lots of others that do this. You know, I'm a fan of the work of the writings of George Sisti, S-I-S-T-I, and his newsletter I just think is a gem. I'm a great fan, again, of Larry Swedrow and Alan Roth and Jonathan Clements and Jason Zweig. Lots of people who are trying to figure out how to help you make better decisions. And I hope that you will share this information with others, with my goal being to get this in front of more investors who could have, I think, a better financial future. Thank you for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.